Center. I'd like to welcome you here, our first anniversary, celebrating the first year in business as the fourth Naval Alcohol Rehab Center, the United States Navy. I'd like to welcome you all again, and I'd like to introduce to you now the commanding officer here at the Naval Alcohol Rehab Center, Commander Bud Smith.
What a party. Everybody celebrating sobriety. That's terrific. Good morning, and welcome to the first anniversary of the Navy Alcohol Rehab Center's establishment. I know you all came to hear Bob Earl and not me, but as the CEO of this facility, I got a few things to say before I turn it over to him. Okay, so bear with me. ARC Pearl Harbor was first authorized by the Secretary of the Navy, John Lehman, on 8 July 1985, which is why we've chosen this date to celebrate our anniversary. For the 12 years prior to our establishment as a separate command, the facility functioned under the name Alcohol Rehabilitation Dry Dock, or ARD, which was a component of Naval Station Pearl Harbor. As ARD Pearl, the facility was instrumental in the treatment of literally thousands of sailors, Marines, and Coast Guardsmen, and dependents as well, and the restoration to productive service. ARD Pearl Harbor was a classic case of Navy can-do. It was both understaffed and underfunded, yet it flourished due to the high level of dedication by people such as Pete Peterson, Ed Cooney, Doug Allman, Tom Lael, Kenmore Fuji, and many, many others too numerous to mention individually. Because they cared so much about the suffering alcoholic, and because they proved so convincingly to line commands that alcoholics can be restored to productive service, that the program works. ARD continue to function, and people continue to make changes in their lives, which have to be regarded as miracles by anybody's standard of measure. Yet while all this was happening, Commander Navy Military Personnel Command in Washington was watching this little ARD and providing funding and personnel support, because he saw that it was helping him accomplish his mission of manning the Navy with high-caliber personnel and providing a much-needed service to Navy personnel and their families in the Mid-Pac area. It had been an objective for many years to upgrade ARD Pearl Harbor to full Alcohol Rehabilitation Center status to make it compatible with the other ARCs in San Diego, Norfolk, and Jacksonville, Florida. In 1984, Commander Navy Military Personnel Command and Naval Station Pearl Harbor agreed to upgrade the ARD to full ARC status, and as I said before, it was finally approved by the Navy Secretary in July 1985. Since that time, ARC Pearl Harbor has been growing, both quantitatively in terms of patient throughput and staff, and qualitatively in terms of patient care. We've seen significant improvements in both areas. Our patient throughput for our first year will be approximately 40% more than the previous year. And our treatment follow-up data indicate that a much higher percentage of our patients are continuing in recovery after treatment. I could give you all the statistics and bore the hell out of you, but I'll just save you the pain and suffering. Next year is expected to bring still more growth to ARC as our staff and our patient load are both scheduled to double next year. I'd like to take this opportunity to express my appreciation to a number of people who provided a great deal of support to us over the past year. Firstly, I'd like to thank Captain Mike Ferguson, who I'm glad to see sitting in the back there, and Commander Bell, Defending Officer and Executive Officer of Naval Station Pearl Harbor, for providing support to us on a broader scale over this past year. In addition to providing us with the facilities and support staff on an additional duty basis when we needed it, the Naval Station has also provided chaplain support to our treatment program, which has been absolutely vital to our program's success. Commander Chris Young, CB to us, raise your hand if you're here this morning, would you, CB? Ah, there you are. Was highly instrumental to our program over the past year. Officer Named Lieutenant Steve Byrd. Chaplain Cook, a senior chaplain at the Naval Station, recognized the importance of this program to the Navy community and managed to make these personnel available, although the station's chaplain resources were already spread extremely thin. I'd also like to thank Captain Donald Ferguson, the commanding officer of the Navy Medical Clinic, for providing medical officer support to us, considering we haven't had our own staff medical officer, a situation which will be rectified next year with our program expansion. Dr. Les Beckler, who also coincidentally joined the retired ranks on 30 June, along with Chaplain Young, provided invaluable support to our therapy program by seeing to it that our patients received excellent medical treatment as well as therapy for their addictive diseases. And a special note of thanks goes out to all of the 12-step groups on the island of Oahu, be they Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, Al-Anons, Adult Children's Alcoholics, and the list is endless, as you all know, for providing the care or the path to continued recovery through their individual caring and sharing of their experience, strength, and hope, your experience, strength, and hope. You have welcomed our patients into your meetings. You have shown them the road to recovery and made them feel welcome. The 12 steps are the cornerstone of the Navy's substance abuse rehabilitation program for both active duty personnel and their families. Our mission could not be achieved. These people could not get well without you, and that is not an overstatement. You are the lifeblood of our program, and we are profoundly grateful and thank you for your support. And last but we've been blessed today, RC, by having a core of highly dedicated individuals who would probably do this for free if they had to. But because this program serves the Navy's interests so well, and it's so strongly supported at all levels of command in the Navy, regardless of what you might have read recently in some circles, these people have the opportunity to do this in a professional capacity, and I'm quite confident that they will be able to continue to do that in the future. To sum this all up, I think it can be said that we at ARC Pearl Harbor have perhaps the most ideal job in the world. We're doing God's work, we're serving the best interests of the Navy, and we're getting paid for it too, and I don't think you can do much better than that. I'd like to call your attention to the rest of the day's activities. Back at ARC, we have booths set up by all the 12-step groups that I've mentioned previously, AA, NA, OA, Al-Anon, ACLA, plus the Honolulu Police Department Drug Awareness Team. They're not passing out free samples in case some of you are trying to think. All the 12-step groups will conduct open meetings from 12 till noon, or from 12, I'll get it right, from 12 to 1 today in the same room where they have their booth set up. With the possible exception of AA, I think AA may very well outgrow their room, in which case AA will move to the big room or the auditorium of the AA. Since these meetings are all open meetings, you're all cordially invited. Even if you are an alcoholic, a drug abuser, or an overeater, here's your chance to find out what these meetings are all about. You've always wondered what goes on behind those doors. You know, what are those people talking about? At 1 p.m. back here in Block Arena, we'll have the play Turnaround, which is a one-hour series of sketches originally sponsored by the Hawaii Chapter of the Child Abuse Prevention Committee. I think you'll find this very informative, moving, and entertaining, and I encourage you to attend. Immediately after Turnaround, we'll have a cake cutting and coffee here in Block Arena. We were originally planning to have this at the ARC, but decided to move it down here so more of you will be able to take part. That explains the difference in some of the times in the original schedule, which we promulgated, and the one that's in the pamphlet. After the cake cutting, Block Arena will again be closed to the public and activities will shift back to the ARC. Base Security wants to have everybody out of the Block Arena parking lot by 2:45 this afternoon, those of you that don't have, that don't otherwise have access to the base. And of course, movies are being shown back at the ARC according to the schedule which is printed in your pamphlet. Now it's my pleasure to introduce this morning's speaker, who is Mr. Bob E. I learned something about this guy just before the start of this morning. Everybody knows this guy is Bobby Earl, and that's what we thought his name was, and that's why it spread that way in some of the literature that we use to advertise this, you know. Well, he has explained to me that, you know, within AA, the tradition is not to use last names, so he came to be known as Bob E. Well, in other places, he's introduced as Bob Earl, and those two got combined to Bob E. Earl. He doesn't even have no initial E, do he? So it's Bob, okay? Bob E. Bob has become a well-known speaker on the 12-step circuit in California and all over the country and in Hawaii also, of course. He's made an inspiring recovery from addiction in his own right, and he serves as an inspiration to everybody who hears him. His sense of humor is absolutely delightful. It's my pleasure and my honor to introduce Mr. Bob Earl.
I thought I'd be hugging a sailor on a stage, you know? Secret part of my past as an alcoholic and drug addict. My name is Bob Earl. I'm a drug addict and an alcoholic. And I love Lays and I love the smell of them, but I can't stand anything around my neck, you know, so I don't wear gold chains or anything. I think I was probably hung in a past life or something, but made me nervous. As they're making a tape of this thing, I feel it really necessary to say for the purpose of anyone listening to the tape that this is not an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. This is an anniversary celebration for the Navy's program in Hawaii, and that all recovery programs are represented here. And so I'm not talking or bound by AA traditions, whatever they may be, on the speaker. They seem to be getting stronger as we get older. Never mind. Anyway. So I'm free to say pretty much what the hell I want to say. And if the tape burns your ass, I'm really sorry. And for those of you here who came to hear a standard AA talk, ACOA talk, OA talk, EAJ talk, I don't care what kind of talk, I may make you uncomfortable. And if I make you uncomfortable, I'm okay with that. It means I've reached down inside of you and turned some stuff that you don't want to look at. And you may hate me for that. That's the part I don't like. But we'll get through it all. I love the Navy and the Navy programs. I think the military programs are real important. I think they have a capacity to reach an awful lot of people. And also they have a more captive audience to work with than we do. It's kind of like when you're in prison, you know, you go to the goddamn meetings and you don't see the free world. You know, it's a simple matter. You don't really have to acknowledge you have a problem or not. You go, you know. I'm sure the Navy applies some of the same gentle pressure to some of its enlisted men. So if you're one of those that has the pressure applied, what the hell, go to the meetings anyway. Recovery. I'm glad that everybody's here from all the programs, because I am of the school that thinks that the feud that exists between AA, NA, OA, EHA, Gamblers Anonymous, adult children, are ridiculous. I mean, I think the fact, well, you can't speak at our meeting because you don't have our disease, or you're not allowed at our meeting because you don't have our disease, borders on goddamn insanity. If there was ever a group of people on the face of the earth that needed each other, it is all of us, you know? And the reason that's so important is, my experience at least has been, that in recovery, those obsessive compulsive activities that I did not participate in before I got to AA, I participated in recovery, right? So it's like to close out other people and act as if they're not important or that we don't identify as silly. Eating is a good example. I used to always participate in OA, and I had a soft spot because I felt that they were getting a bad rap. And I never had any identity as a compulsive overeater or any identity with any problem with food until I was 15 years sober and quit smoking. 15 years sober, I gave up cigarettes. And in the process of giving up cigarettes, I discovered two things. First of all, I did not know that cigarette tobacco was cured in sugar. Once I smoked no longer, my body suddenly said, I want sugar. My body wanted serious sugar. My body didn't want lightweight sugar, it wanted serious sugar. And I began to treat sugar eating like drug addiction, right? And I would be sitting home in a little condo I lived up in Montecito at 10 minutes to 11 in the evening. And I'd say quietly, well, there's no sugar in the house, but it's okay. I don't have a problem with sugar, so there's no need to have sugar in the house. I can have a glass of water and go to bed like any other human being, you know, like just normal folks next door. 5 minutes of 11, I'm out the door on a dead run. In my car, I'm doing 100 miles an hour down Santa Ynez Road into Montecito Village, where I come to a broadside stop in front of the 31 Flavors ice cream store. I go through the door as the guy's about to lock up with a goddamn key, right? I buy my quart of pralines and cream, my jar of butterscotch topping, my jar of dry roasted cashew peanuts. I go home and get a bowl, not a goddamn cereal bowl, but a serious bowl, you know, the kind you mix ingredients in, and I make an ice cream sundae. Man, I was in a marriage at the time that was going sour, and so the sugar worked a multitude of wonderful things in my life. First of all, if you're hypoglycemic, and most drug addicts and alcoholics are, so save your money on the blood test. If you eat sugar and your eyes sort of fog over, just, you know you are. Or if your sugar eating reaches the point where you get a quick high and then go to sleep. And I had reached that stage of sugar eating where it just kind of put me in a coma. You know, consume a large quantity of sugar, and I just sort of went. And it was great. I didn't have to deal with the wife. I didn't have to deal with life. I could just eat sugar. One problem began to arise. I kept getting bigger. And as I got bigger, I had to buy bigger pants. And I kept buying bigger pants. And finally, I bought a pair of new pants. And the next day, I couldn't get them fastened. Okay? I don't remember how big they were. 38, 40, whatever the hell they were. And I looked at myself in the mirror, and I looked at these pants, and I said, okay, this is it. These are the biggest pants you're ever going to own as long as you live. You can eat anything you want to eat, go anywhere you want to go, do anything you want to do, but these are the biggest pants you'll ever own. So if you want to spend the rest of your life in the wintertime wearing Hawaiian shirts out, you know, to cover up the fact that you can't fasten your pants, I don't care. And a friend of mine came to me and said, eat red apples. Every time you want sugar, eat a red, delicious apple. And he said, give yourself permission to eat as many apples as it takes. I don't care if you eat 100 apples a day. So I said, okay, great. And I began to eat apples. By the box full, I ate apples. And I got off sugar. And the weight began to go down. Now, all this is taking place with somebody who at the time is like 16 years sober, okay? 16 years clean and sober. 16 years of supposed, quote, recovery. 100 miles an hour down dark side streets in the middle of the night to get my sugar. But I'm recovered. Watch me walk into any meeting. I looked good. But then early on in recovery, I learned the essential trick of recovery. And that is, you adopt an AA identity. Okay? Now, the personality that you adopt doesn't have a goddamn thing to do with reality. Okay? I put mine together from a little of this speaker, and a little of this speaker, and a little of this sponsor, and a little of this sponsor, and a little of this guy, and I created a person. All right? Now, this person I would kind of put on in the parking lot before I went into the meeting. All right, get out of my car, and suddenly became Bob E. I would walk into the meeting. I always parked in the same spot, went to the same meeting, sat in the same chair, drank coffee out of the same cup, and said the same goddamn things, right? I thought that was recovery. But the most important part about my AA personality was I had watched the people in AA very carefully, and I knew one thing about good members of any recovery program, and that is that they are always fine, no matter what. You know, George would walk into a meeting, you walk up to George and say, George, how are you? George, I'm fine, thanks, how are you? I'd say, I'm okay. And George would walk off. And 2 minutes later, somebody would come up and nudge my arm and say, hey, did you hear about George? No, God, what happened to George? Well, poor George, he lost his job, they repossessed his car, and his wife divorced him. Well, I understood what they're saying to me, that if you get your car repossessed, lose your job, your wife divorces you, you're okay anyway. You're fine anyway. So I became fine. No matter what, I was fine. I'd walk into me and someone would say, hi, Bob, how are you? I'd say, I'm fine, thank you. When the most honest thing I could have done would have been drop to my knees, grab the person around the ankles, and begin to sob uncontrollably on their shoes, you know. Right? The problem with doing that is, if I did that, you would find out my secret. And I have guarded my secret since I was a child. And that secret is, something's wrong with me. I know it and you don't. And I'm not going to let you know it. And not only is something wrong with me, in any situation, anywhere, anytime, under any circumstances, I am not enough. It doesn't matter if I'm speaking in a Skid Row meeting, in a Skid Row mission, at an AA meeting, or if I'm at an executive level meeting at a motion picture studio. I'm not enough, and I know it, and my responsibility is to keep you from finding it out. And that's what I gotta work on. So if I'm gonna be a good AA, I'm gonna be fine. I'm fine, see? And that to me is one of the tragedies that has just somehow come to materialize in recovery. That once you cross through these doors, you somehow have stepped into the magic kingdom. And in the magic kingdom, everybody's fine. I ain't fine. I'm not now fine, have never been fine, probably never will be fine. Okay? That's the number one goddamn lie, you know? I'm sober, I'm clean, I'm having a good time some days, other days I want to kill myself. I rolled in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous August 28, 1962. I was 26 years old and never at any time throughout an 11-year insane history of drug addiction, alcoholism, shootouts with the police, which I lost. A lot of incredible bullshit went on. I never, ever, on any given occasion, ever considered taking my life. Never crossed my mind. I had to become a sober, clean member of the program in recovery. And then I started thinking about killing myself regularly. Okay? Many mornings, suicide seemed the only possible solution to the pending day, okay? What I have since learned from a lot of so-called learned, skilled, professional people, and I have no reason to doubt them because it's been my personal experience, that part of the disease of eating or addiction or alcoholism is that we are easily overwhelmed. I am easily overwhelmed. But you can't be fine and be easily overwhelmed. I mean, it won't work. It won't go together. I can't look good and be fine and be, oh, God, I can't handle it, you know, at the same time. And the God, I can't handle it is the truth. And the I am fine is the lie. I wake up a lot of mornings still today. I'm almost 24 years clean and sober. And if my mind gets to me, before I get a chance to get out of bed, I'm dead. I'm dead. See, my drug of choice in recovery is anxiety. Okay? I can't get high anymore, but boy, I can get nuts. I can go right over the goddamn scale, man, and right off the other side. She catch me in traffic in Los Angeles. I can just go right off the planet. You know, it's wonderful. Anxiety. And nothing works better for me to create anxiety in me than worry. I love to worry. I gotta worry about this afternoon, tomorrow, next week, next month, 10 years from now, what I'm gonna do when I retire. How about when I'm old? Oh my God, what am I gonna do? And I discovered one day, I'll tell you how much I love to worry. One day I was watching a boring football game on TV, and I started worrying, and I don't even remember about what, but it was serious stuff. I'm talking perspiring kind of worry, you know, really, really worrying. And then suddenly the game got interesting, right? The action picked up, and I got all involved in the action of the football game, right? And then the ball game got dull again. And I found myself laying there on the sofa trying to remember what it was I was worried about. You see? It wasn't okay to be okay. It wasn't okay to not be worrying. It wasn't okay to not be serious. It wasn't okay for things to not be difficult. See? Because I am an adult child. I was raised in an alcoholic household. And if I've learned anything about what seems to be pretty traditional among adult children is things are difficult. Nothing comes easy. Life is hard. You must pay the goddamn price. If it comes to you easy, it is sinful and it will be taken away. You're screwed. You know? So stop being frivolous, you jerk, and get serious. And yet, in my travels over the years, I have had the privilege to meet some people who I consider highly evolved people spiritually, who I would have to say walk daily, every waking moment, hand in hand with God. That their consciousness and God's is one from the time they get up in the morning until they go to bed at night, if they should even choose to do that, right? And if they, all these people have one common denominator, it's silliness. It is silliness. They giggle, hee. You know? I just spent some time with probably the most evolved person I've ever met in my life, and his very first words were, "You must understand, this is not some weird little Indian sitting in a robe alongside a river, either." I said, "You must," the guy living in a palatial house in Palos Verdes who made a few bucks in his own right, you know? And he said, "You must learn that enlightenment means lighten up." Well, and he giggled, he went, "God bless you." Yeah. He said, "The problem you have living at the human level is that you all suffer from an illusion of separation. You suffer from an illusion of separation from God, from your fellow man, from the planet itself, from life. And it is nothing but an illusion." There is no separation. And that you're only here to do one thing. Learn. Earth is a school. Therefore, if you're only here to learn, you cannot fail. Ever in your life. Because if the sole purpose is to learn, there can be no failure. God bless you. I don't know when he's going to learn to take this stuff serious, for Christ's sake. Stop having a good time. Okay. I hope you can keep up with me. Now I'm back to 16 years sober. I'm not smoking. I'm losing a few pounds. I don't eat red meat. See, I talk about a lot of stuff because I talk about nutrition, I talk about exercise, I talk about therapy. I talk about a lot of these things in, quote, Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And people just get red in the face and they get angry. And I talk about nutritional consciousness at OA meetings. And they get angry, you know? Food's not our problem. We have an emotional problem. We don't talk about food.
We pay too much attention to food. All of our focus is on food.
Oh, it should be. Yeah? It should be.
I mean, I was never so glad in my life. They just recently, for those of you who don't know, threw out the OA eating plans because finally 375,000 doctors convinced them that nutritionally were terrible, that they were killing their goddamn membership with the eating plan they gave them. Okay? Now, you say, well, geez, I mean, but they, you know, were into food and into fridge and into this and ate this and did this and did that and did this and did that, and how come, you know, they can't, they got to look at the emotions, they can't look at the food. No. See, I see part of the problem in a lot of the recovery is that there's a lot of new information available to us, and we're closing our goddamn minds to it. We're doing the very thing that the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says don't do unless the one thing that'll keep you in everlasting ignorance is contempt prior to an investigation, and we are refusing to investigate. And one of the things that has come up and is really, really clear is that an immense amount of the food that's put on the market today that is processed or has salt or has other ingredients in it has an addictive, physically addictive quality. So if you are a compulsive overeater and you're trying to work on an eating plan and your eating plan is not nutritionally sound and your eating plan includes foods that are processed foods that contain these chemical ingredients and you suddenly find yourself wanting to eat more, you're going to do what every good compulsive obsessive personality does. You're going to beat yourself up. You're going to say, what's wrong with me? Where am I emotionally at fault? What did I do wrong? I'm not enough. I can't work this program because I want to eat more. So something's wrong with me. Nothing wrong with you. You're eating shit. That's the problem. I was really going to try not to, you know. I figured, God, it's the Navy celebration, Robert. The least you can do is that I can't, you know? By the way, if the Navy's really appreciative of this talk, you can send me up the next F-14 that goes out of here for a little ride. I'd love to go. I still got to get, you know, off somehow. I know I'd probably throw up and pee my pants, but I want to go anyway, you know? It's like Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I'm convinced beyond, I mean, I'm willing to die behind this one. If Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob sat down this afternoon, August 8th or whatever the hell, July, I've lost track of time, I've been on so many planes the last week, whatever day it is, anyway, today, if they sat down this afternoon, Bill and Dr. Bob, for the first time in the history of man, and they created the program of Alcoholics Anonymous this afternoon, integral parts of that program would be therapy, nutrition, and exercise. You see, because they said countless times that we're suffering from a disease that's physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. And yet we don't treat that. We don't treat that. I mean, I don't know how the Navy handles their treatment facilities, but I walk through treatment facilities on the mainland, and the only thing they're not getting is drugs and alcohol. That's it. That's the only thing they're not getting. They're getting 174 pounds of sugar a day, 3,000 grams of caffeine, and might as well be injecting it out of a goddamn turkey baster, you know. You know? We're going to help you with your drug and alcohol program, you know. Yeah. Have 164 cups of coffee and settle down, man. And a new guy goes to bed at night thinking he's fucked. Something's wrong with him. Oh, my heart. Shit, I'm really must feel. You know. I'm a terrible person. I wonder what's causing this emotionally, you know. I must really be screwed up. Many years ago, when Alcoholics Anonymous first started, there was a guy in the first 100 by the name of Tom Powers. But you, those of you who want to learn about Bill Wilson, I suggest you read the book, Pass It On. And I love him more after reading that book than after reading his biography and after, you know, spending time with people who spent time with him, because Pass It On points up the thing I think about Bill that is so critical for me, and that is that he was a seeker. He never stopped looking for more. And he said that we've got to be flexible. We've got to be flexible, and we've not, in my opinion, we aren't flexible anymore. We're rigid. You know, and if anything will destroy me personally, it's rigidity. I break. I'm a vegetarian. I don't eat dairy products. But goddamn it, if I'm stuck in Albuquerque, New Mexico at 11 o'clock at night and I'm hungry, I'll have nachos. Okay? I will not sit and starve myself to death or beat myself to death. I won't be rigid. And we've gotten really rigid. And Bill Manny tried niacin. They had an LSD experiment, guys, our founders. You know, they all went off to Canada and got whacked out on acid. Okay? They did it meaning well. It was they had a real good idea that chemically you could induce the emotional bottom that the alcoholic reaches when he says, I've had enough. And that was the sole purpose of the experiment. And when Bill was doing this, his best friend and kind of guide or somebody who stayed close to him was this Tom Powers. And Bill went, for Christ's sakes, he went to a nutritionist the last week of his life. He fought cigarette smoking the entire time he was sober. He wanted to quit more than anything else in the world. He quit 2 years before, but it was too late. He died of emphysema anyway. Bill Wilson was in therapy, 4 years sober, 1937. Listen to what I'm saying. In therapy, 1937, and people will stand at the podium at AA meetings and pound the podium and say, AA is enough. It may be for some people, but it isn't for all of us. Okay? And if it isn't, God damn it, give us the freedom to go out and pick up the other tools we need because, you know, therapy was not popular in 1937. It wasn't like, you know, I live in Southern California where if you're not talking about your therapist, you obviously are poor, you know. You don't have any money. Well, my therapist can beat up your therapist, you know. So I'm in an area where it's a very in thing to do, you know. Even in the program, it's not too bad, except with the old-timers. They get nuts, of course. They know all they want to know. They still believe AA is where you come to, you know, stay until you're lucky enough to die. Well, I believe that. Didn't you believe that at your first meeting? I mean, I came in Outlaws and Novices. I listened to the people, went to some meetings, and I concluded that I can't drink and use anymore, and I'm not lucky enough to be dead. You know, so this is where you stay until you're lucky enough to die, you know. So I come to meetings, raise my hand, make coffee, talk to people, shake hands, you know, take a couple of drunks home, and if I'm lucky, soon I'll die. You know, there's a new consciousness coming. I'll give you an example of this. There's a new consciousness coming into the program. I love it. There was a couple of guys a while back who came into Southern California who were wonderful, wonderful guys. These guys had been everywhere on this planet. They had spent years in India with the gurus. They had walked the rivers. They had lived in the caves. They had been in the Himalayas and spent something like 6.5 years with the high lamas learning and teaching and learning. They even spoke their language, which I understand is incredibly difficult to learn. And they walk, you know, they have been everywhere. They have gone through the test, walked the coals, been in the mountains, climbed the Andes, bare feet in the snow. They have done everything. And the only thing that was giving them problems with the consciousness of the material they were getting was the heroin that they were using. Okay? They had been vegetarians most of their lives, and they were very attuned to exercise, to yoga, and all these things. But the heroin seemed to somehow filter out the importance of what it was they were learning. They came into the program, and we gave them a book, the big book. We said, here, read this. And unlike anybody I have ever met in my life, they took that big book and opened it up and looked at it and said, wow, this is good stuff. I really like this. God, these 12 steps are incredible. Do you know that the Essenes were saying some of this stuff 2,000 years before Christ ever hit the planet? This is heavyweight stuff. This will deal with this problem. And they just started working steps like, you know, you go out and sign a contract to buy a new car, for Christ's sake. Oh, this is great. Yeah, write this. Oh, yeah. Oh, the exact nature, of course. I understand what that means. And, you know, and away they went. And about 6 months later, man, two of them are bopping into a clubhouse in the San Fernando Valley. And walk in the door, and there in his chair is one of our 33-year sober old-timers with his coffee cup, his cigarettes, and his pile of cookies in front of him, and his kid looks at him and says, what the fuck are you doing? And this old-timer, staunch, stalwarty, respected, looks up at him like, what do you mean? And the kid says, my God, man, you're getting another shot at life here. God, through Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, implanted information to all of you. And he's giving you another chance to live. You're given another chance. You've been raised from the goddamn ashes. Raised from the ashes. You've got a new life, and you're sitting in this chair killing yourself. And the old-timer looked him in the eyes and said, when you're sober as long as I am, you'll understand.
I sure hope not. I sure hope not. I sure hope I never understand, Sam.
Because that stuff wasn't acceptable to Bill. It wasn't acceptable to Dr. Bond. And you go out to do something here and people go nuts, you know, and they forget, for Christ's sake, Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob used to have seances at Dr. Bob's house. They used to talk to the goddamn spirits. They were looking anywhere they could, you know.
Hey, well, any of you guys know, you know, can you give us a hand here, you know, get us some more help?
The 20th anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous was held in St. Louis. A was 20 years old. 20 years old. This is an official, recognized, sanctioned by General Service, World Service, whatever the hell it is, AA convention. The only one that's actually truly AA. The rest of them are not, no matter what they said. Three of the main speakers were as follows: a Catholic priest, a Protestant minister, and a psychiatrist.
Isn't that interesting? And we have all these table pounders telling us, this is enough. This is enough. And I find people resist only what they're afraid of. Only what they're afraid of. Anyhow, this guy, Tom Powers, he stuck around AA for a long time and finally said, about 15, 20 years ago, and he was a circuit speaker, a recognized member of AA, says, you guys have blown it. You have watered this down. It is not what it was intended to be. And he believes in his mind and in his heart that the sole purpose of the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the meetings and the fellowship and the working with a newcomer and the going to the prisons and whatever the treatment facilities, whether they be Navy or private or anything else, is to effect in the alcoholic a spiritual awakening. That is the only function of it. And it, in the process, somehow got watered down, so he just tripped off quietly to the Catskill Mountains in New York, and he decided to do it his way, and he opened his own little place. In the beginning, he started out by just going in New York and picking drunks up off the Bowery and taking them out there. Today, it's a rather large facility. It's a community, as a matter of fact. Tom himself is in his 70s. His youngest child is 2. Tom is a recognized yoga. He's cured himself of cancer. And for you in the Navy who come through this treatment center here and think it's a bitch, let me give you a little information. Day one, if you walk through the doors at East Ridge, this is what you will give up. You will give up drugs. You'll give up alcohol. You'll give up sugar. You'll give up caffeine. You'll give up cigarettes. You'll give up processed food. You'll even give up sex until they can teach you the difference between sick sex and sane sex. You'll give up all compulsive, obsessive behavior of any kind. You'll learn to get up early in the morning and meditate for a half hour. You'll then go to chapel. You'll sing psalmody songs for a half hour. You'll exercise aerobically for an hour. You'll then have a nutritionally conscious, carefully balanced breakfast. And the rest of the day will be spent working really hard, because most alcoholics and addicts don't really know how to work really hard. And the rest of the time will be in groups and encounters. Lunch is a balanced meal, a little fish, salad, nighttime salad, vegetable, potato, stuff like that. That's your day. That's it. That's the program. Tom very quietly says, people are being kept asleep. And as long as you're going to have the other chemicals in your system, you're asleep. And so he wants to wake people up. On this property, in this facility, are children 12 and 13 years old who have never seen a television set. They've never read a magazine. Oh, they've been taught history, and they've been taught geography, and they've been taught every form of philosophy known to man. All the ways and points of view of looking at life. They've learned them all. And I gotta tell you, if you ever physically, firsthand, want to see God, you look into the eyes of one of these children. See, because there's nothing between them and their soul. They just look at you. And there it is. Now, I don't know about anybody else in any of these other recovery programs, but I was born, when I was born that first day, when I was born, I was given birth to, and I was happy, joyous, and free. And from that point on, due to the circumstances of my life, a lot of things happened to me, and all of them destroyed my capacity to be happy, joyous, and free.
And my sole function in recovery, as I'm coming to understand it now, is to get back to what God originally intended for me to be in the first place, which is happy, joyous, and free. Lighten up. You know, lighten up. That's what it's about. Happy, joyous, and free. And happy and joyous and free doesn't mean that you can't protect your country. It doesn't mean that you can't be a man. It doesn't mean you can't be a father. It doesn't mean you can't be a woman or a mother or a contractor or a bulldozer driver or a florist or a writer or a poet or whatever the hell you want to be. It just means be happy, joyous, and free at whatever you do. That's really what it's about. But you see, my problem is because of things that have transpired in my life, I don't know how. I think something's wrong with me, and I'm not enough. And if something's wrong with me, and I'm not enough, I can't be happy, joyous, and free. Okay? We are now back to I'm 16 years old. Hey, I live my life like this. At least it keeps from being boring, you know? Where are you, Bob? God, I don't know. Let me look at my watch and see. I'm 16 years sober. I've given up cigarettes, I've given up red meat, and I've given up sugar. Friends of mine come to me and say, Bob, you should start running. It'll be good for you to run. So I start running. By now, I'm 17 years sober. I've just begun to run a little bit. My life is in great shape. I'm a television writer. I live in a penthouse at the beach, drive an expensive car, have a gorgeous girlfriend, and want to die. Nothing's changed. And I came into the program, you know, I have a 10th grade education, I've failed English ever since the 4th grade, and I'm a phonetic speller. And yet, 5 years sober, I wound up being a writer. God's little idea of a joke on the industry. Not me, Not true. It's not a joke. I have a lot of things to say, and I'm about to, you know, change what I write and start saying them. And maybe, well, we'll see. Anyhow, maybe we'll get to that. Maybe we'll. Anyhow, a friend of mine says to me, because I was in terrible pain. I was 17 years sober, and I did not know where to turn. I had written 32 inventories. Couldn't write any more goddamn inventories of my life. Depend. I have to write your life. My mind, I was done with, you know. I sponsored probably 100 guys. I traveled probably 40,000 AA miles a year minimum in the car, not counting what I travel on planes. I was well. I was recovered. I was okay. I was fine. I just wanted to die. That's all. Just wanted to die. Other than that, everything was okay. My life looked good. I looked good. The people in my life looked good. Looking good was important. I'd rather die than look foolish or silly. See, that's another problem here. They say to you, surrender to God. Everything that I've ever read about God or about metaphysics or about a spiritual life, there seems to be that there is one absolutely essential, critical ingredient if you really want to let go and let God. And that is the capacity for spontaneity. You must be able to be spontaneous. Because all the teachers I have ever come in contact with say the same thing. Nothing is permanent on this planet. Everything changes constantly. The only permanent thing is change. Everything else is coming and going and changing. And you must learn to flow with this. Come on, would you give me a rest? Okay? I can't even go places I haven't been before. You know, because if you say to me, hey, there's this new place down the road, you'll love it. Great people, neat meditation class, they say terrific stuff, they're really far out, it's wonderful, it'll raise you to a new level of spiritual consciousness, I go nuts inside. I go right over the edge. Oh, well, yeah, okay, what do they wear? I mean, how do they talk? Do they talk, you know, high or low, or do they laugh, geez, I don't know. Oh, you know what? I got a newcomer I got to go get. I don't think I'm going to be able to to go. See? And I spent my whole life like that. My whole life in social sitting. I'd walk into a room full of people I didn't know, and the very first thing I would do would be clamp my back against the wall. Okay? And then I would watch the people in the room. And I would see how they stood, watch how they shook hands, how they laughed, you know, how they related to each other. And once I decided I could relate like they related, I would walk out into the room and stand like they stood and shook hands like they shook hands and laughed like they laughed, you see. The tragedy of that is, whoever I am, I left me on the wall. See, because whoever I am, something's wrong with me, and I'm not enough. So I gotta come into your little party or your little gathering, and I gotta be who you are, because I know that you're gonna throw me away, because you're gonna find me out. I'm not okay. And that, I believe, is the crust inside, the very little bottom piece inside every one of us in every recovery program, no matter what it is that we live with that's killing us, is that I'm not enough, something's wrong with me, I'm not okay, and I gotta do everything I can to pretend to be somebody other than who I am so that you will love me. And the tragedy is, as long as I'm pretending to be somebody other than who I am, I'm not here. I'm not present for my life. I am an act. I am a volleyball routine. There is no one home. No one home. Okay. So now, 17 years sober, wanting to die, a friend says to me, I think you should go see a therapist. I was open-minded about therapy like most AAs. Anyone I sponsored went into therapy, I fired them immediately. I would make the standard speech. Well, obviously, AA and I aren't enough. Go find a sponsor, and who is? Or perhaps call your therapist at 3 o'clock in the morning. See if he answers the goddamn phone. Unfortunately, I was in too much pain to care, so I went. As I had a lot of lousy luck with relationships throughout recovery, I picked a woman, thinking perhaps she could give me some inside information as to how to get along with you girls. Little did I know, the damage was so deep. See, I always thought you were the enemy. Yeah, you were okay, but you were a problem to be dealt with. Also, I wasn't in touch with my feelings. If you're not in touch with your feelings, you can't have a relationship. Because you have nothing to give the other person. I mean, I can't give you anything. If I don't know what my feelings are, I can't give you anything. And the bigger tragedy is, if I don't have, not in touch with my feelings, and you have feelings, we got a real problem. Because I don't understand your feelings. And see, if my basic whole motivation is something's wrong with me and I'm not enough, there's something that's absolutely critical to all areas of my life, and that's control. I must have control over me, I must have control over you, and I must have control over our environment. And if you begin to cry when I think you should be laughing, I'm in trouble. First of all, I think it's my fault that you're crying instead of laughing. Secondly, I think I have to fix it. It's my responsibility to make you okay, because I am an adult child of alcoholics. And that's the role most of us fell into as children. What can we do to keep peace? What can we do to stop mommy and daddy from fighting? Forget that we are a child with real feelings. Your feelings get screwed early. And if you're raised by dysfunctional parents. I love one line of John Bradshaw. One of the classic remarks that the parents put on you is this one. You don't have to go to the bathroom. Kid stands there and goes, Oh, I thought I did. God, I wonder what that feeling is then. It's not bathroom, it's... So you're on the road down now. It's goodbye, Charlie, man. You don't trust your feelings. And also, you know, one of the things I love around the programs is the women are always screaming at us men in recovery, you guys are unfeeling. You're not in touch with your feelings. I mean, women in Southern California even started a meeting for women who were in relationships with men who aren't in touch with their feelings. No, I don't know why I'm not in touch with my feelings. When I was 3 years old, I fell off my tricycle and I tore the skin off my knee and it started to bleed. And I came running in the house with tears streaming down my face and I ran up to the alcoholic father sitting in his chair sucking on his beer. And I said to this alcoholic father, I said, with tears streaming down my face, because this is the first blood I've seen coming out of my own body. Stop crying.
I can't.
If you don't stop crying, I'll give you something to cry for. Okay, I got it. They didn't give birth to an idiot. Yeah, I understand. You have pain, you don't cry. You don't cry no matter what happens in your life. You don't cry. Because if you cry, you get your goddamn brains punched out. Because there's something wrong with you if you cry. Well, 13 years later, I was 16 years old. I laid in an emergency receiving hospital in downtown Los Angeles with police bullets in my body. And I looked at the goddamn surgeon and told him to take his anesthetic and stick it in his ass. My father would have been proud. Of course, I fainted when he was halfway in after the first bullet, but that's beside the point. You know, I looked good for a minute. You know, I was tough for a minute. And the other thing you learn in an alcoholic household is not to laugh. You learn not to laugh. You see, because giggling cannot be allowed in a house of paranoids. Because if you have a giggling fit with a paranoid in the house, they know who you're laughing at. And you're finished. Okay, then I start to grow up. I don't know how the hell to relate to a woman or a relationship or anything else. The only yardstick I got is mom and dad. That's all I know about a relationship. You know, and yet I spend years beating myself up for not being able to be a good functioning partner in a relationship. And I forget one thing. Everything I do today is learned behavior. Do you ever throw a ball to a child that doesn't know how to catch a ball? I mean, catching a ball is not a normal, instinctive reaction for any human animal. You throw a ball to a child and it's... Throw it to him again. You show him. Catch it. Throw it to him again. Right? If you took a 50-year-old man who had never been taught to catch a ball and threw him a ball, it would go... Learned behavior. I was taught not to cry. I didn't do that. It wasn't my idea. I didn't say, Mom and Dad, teach me how not to cry. I was taught not to laugh. I didn't say, Mom and Dad, I want to go through life being serious because I'm afraid to laugh because I'll get hit or shoved away or no one will love me. I learned how not to do these things, okay? So part of what therapy's been for me has been to unlearn and in the process to learn new behavior. Anyway, we're back. I go to the therapist for the first time. I sit down with this woman and she says, tell me a little bit about yourself. I said, well, I was thrown out of Manual Arts High School. She says, start with your childhood. Tell me a little bit about yourself. I said, well, I was thrown out of Manual Arts High School when I was 15 years old. I discovered the wonderful world of drugs and alcohol. I spent the next 11 years in the streets running drugs and drinking alcohol, and I came to the programs of NA and AA 17 years ago. She said, no, wait a minute. You weren't born at 15 years of age. I said, tell me about your childhood. She said, I don't remember anything. She said, what do you mean you don't remember anything? I said, I don't remember anything. I can remember perhaps three things that have happened to me since I was from birth to 15. And at that moment, the smile came on her face. And at the time, being a self-serving person, I interpreted the smile as self-serving. I thought what the smile meant, I have finally found somebody I'm going to write a paper on that's going to get me published and make me famous. I didn't know that the smile was very simply saying this. If you stick it out, if you stay with me and stick it out, I'm going to introduce you to somebody you never met at any time in your life. I'm going to introduce you to you. And in the process of introducing to you, I'm going to introduce you into a child that lives inside of you. It's been waiting for you. At that time, for 45 years, this child is waiting. And we began the process. And at the same time I'm beginning this process, I'm starting to run with my friends. My friends are saying to me, "You run funny." Well, I drank a lot of alcohol, used a lot of drugs, and I had a bad attitude, and all my bones aren't where they're supposed to be. Some of them have moved. Some of them have had pieces shattered out of them by bullets. My pelvis has been snapped in half, put back together. I was the kind of person that was much better for you to come at from behind, so my back has been literally destroyed. So I run a little strange. I have friends who say they could spot me a mile away in a strange city and they'd know me if I was running down the road. So these friends say to me, "Look, you know what we got to do for you? We got to get your feet going straight. If we can get your feet going straight in front of you, you can run further, faster, with less effort." Sounded like a good idea to me. So they said, "Look, the best sports medicine podiatrist in the world is in Long Beach." I lived in Santa Monica at the time, maybe 35 miles away. "Go to Long Beach, see this guy, he'll fix you up." Long Beach is too far for me, I'm sorry. I can't drive me 35 miles to a doctor. I'll drive you 35 miles to the doctor. If you call me up on the phone and said, "I gotta go see the sports medicine podiatrist in Long Beach, it's really important, it's critical in my running, would you pick me up and take me?" I'll say, "Yeah, I'll come there and get you in a minute." You're worth taking to the best person. I'm not. Because there's something wrong with me. And I'm not enough. So I go see a podiatrist in Century City, 5 minutes away, who knows nothing about running, makes me some orthotics that must have been made for a goddamn lumberjack. I go out and run a mile and a half, and now I'm crippled over like this, right? My back is out. So my friends say, "Ah, easy, no problem. In Pasadena, which is also 35 miles away, the best sports medicine chiropractors in the world. They work with the Olympic team. They'll have you back on your feet and nothing flat. Go see them." I can't drive me to Pasadena. It's as far as Long Beach. So I go see this chiropractor in Marina Del Rey, which is also 5 minutes away, who's 100 pounds overweight, smoking cigarettes, and doesn't even know what the word running means, right? By the time he's done with me, I'm like this. Finally, out of absolute complete desperation and pain, I drive myself to Pasadena. 3 visits to Pasadena, and I'm straight. I'm great. And now the guys in Pasadena say, "Go to Long Beach." So I put myself in the car, and I drive to Long Beach, and I don't want to go to Long Beach, and I don't know why. Now the resistance is just more than no self-worth and no self-esteem. There's serious resistance. And I get to Long Beach, and I'm sitting in this little room in that strange chair where you sit with both legs straight out in front of you, and the nicest, gentlest guy I ever met in my life comes in. The guy's a marathon runner himself. He is a sweetheart of a human being. He comes in and he says hi and looks right at my right foot. He goes and picks up my right foot, starts to turn it and looks at it and he says, "What happened to your foot when you were a kid?" I said, "Nothing. Why?" He says, "Oh no, something happened. It's practically a club foot. It lays on its side." I said, "Well, maybe I was born that way." He said, "No, this is not from birth. This is a structural change in the foot that's happened after birth." And suddenly I wanted to throw up, but I didn't understand why. And I was sad, and I didn't understand why. And I was angry, and I didn't understand why. And this is where the problem with me and feelings comes in. I can't be spontaneous, which means I need control, and feelings can't be controlled. And my mind hates two things. My mind hates God, because God requires spontaneity, and my mind hates feelings because they can't be controlled. You see, an example would be, because sometimes my feelings are inappropriate to the situation, and I look silly, and I don't want to look silly. An example would be, if my neighbor and I walked out of our houses in the morning and went to our cars, and we tried to start our cars, and his car didn't start, and my car didn't start,
he would go back in the house and call the auto club. I would go back in the house and call suicide prevention, okay? He's got a small problem with his car not starting. My life is over. That is an inappropriate feeling to the circumstances. But it's me. But it's me. You see? And I somehow have come under the misbelief that I've got to be perfect for you to love me, for me to love me, and for God to love me. And for those of you who really are into understand ACA and the issue about the child, I mean, for a minute, just think for 1 minute in trying to help yourself in recovery. If you walked up to the street and laying in the street was a wounded child, you would not wait for the child to heal before you picked him up. So why the hell do we sit around all these recovery programs waiting for ourselves to heal before we pick ourselves up? I'm not okay till I'm okay. That's bullshit. That's the lie. That's saying I'm fine. Well, I'm pretending to be fine so I'm okay so that everybody will, you know, love me. Maybe I want to call suicide prevention when my car doesn't start. Who cares? You know, big goddamn deal. That's just me. As this guy Bradshaw says, which is so beautiful, the necessity to be in touch with your feelings is very simply this. On any moment when you are in touch with your feeling, you are in touch with the reality of who you are at that minute. Feelings aren't important. Nonsense. Feelings are who I am. They're who I am. Okay? I mean, I've been banging this program around for a while. I've learned something. I'm not the money I have or I don't have, which is the case right now. I'm not the car I drive that can be ripped off tomorrow. I'm not the place I live in. I can be foreclosed on or thrown out. I'm not the clothes they wear. God knows I'm not my personality. I can change that from room to room out here in the treatment facility. You know? Oh, I'm an ACA. I'm a dope figure. I just wander from room to room and be wherever the hell it is I have to be. So I can't be my personality. So I must be what I feel. The very things I run from are who I am. I run from the feeling. Well, I go home from this foot doctor, and my feelings are out of control, and there's no reason for them. I'm angry, I'm sick, I'm sad, I'm upset, the phone rings, I pick it up, and on the other end of the phone is my mother, who is just the car alcoholic in my family, who has just come from her foot doctor. Her, and she's like bitching because he didn't cut her toenails straight. I said to my mother, I said, look, as long as we're on the subject of feet, what happened to mine? I gotta tell you, man, for those of you who are gonna begin this process and go back and try and dig that crap out, dealing with a co-alcoholic can be like dealing with a wall. You know, they don't even know we were there. And don't want to admit we were there either. They don't even want to admit they were there. Well, they weren't, really. So anyway, after a little badgering, she says to me, well, when you were a little boy, you had very high arches. And you required special shoes. And they were expensive shoes. Very expensive shoes. She repeated 5 times at least how expensive these shoes were. I hung up the phone and I felt worse than I have ever felt in my life. I wanted to cry, I wanted to destroy the apartment, and I wanted to throw up, and I didn't know why. And I was up all night, pacing and walking. I'm a pacer, like I said, anxiety, you know. I'm a mover when I'm nuts. Next day, my schedule with my therapist, I walk in her office door, she says, hi, how are you? And I go, yeah! No longer do I say I'm fine. And I tell her what the problem is, and she says, well, let's go back and see what we find. So we go back, and what we found is a 2.5-year-old little boy standing in a hallway in an apartment in Denver, Colorado. Cute little kid. And he's there in the hallway with his mother, and he's got tears streaming down his face. And he's pointing to his right foot. And what this little boy is telling his mother is that the shoe was too small, and that it hurts his foot so bad, he's crying. He's crying from the pain. And the mother says to the little boy, my mother says to me, shh, not too loud. Your father will hear, and he'll be angry.
And I finally understood, at that moment, the light went on. Why, all my life, I felt like something was wrong with me, and I'm not enough. You see, because if I'm not worth buying shoes for that fit, if I'm not worth having the pain-free physical life as a child given to me by the parents, I have no values. And if I have no value, I ain't got to pretend that I really count, that I'm really important. So I finally understood what was going on. The parent issue is a real simple one, and I will, it's, again, I love quoting John Bradshaw. One of the things he says I love, he has a line where he says, everybody is responsible and nobody is to blame. A girl I knew was celebrating her first birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous, and her mother, who was 4 years sober, called her on the phone. Her mother said to her very simply this, because they keep saying, forgive your parents, right? Her mother said, look, on this your first birthday, the only present I can give you is this. I want you to know that I understand that I, your mother, am responsible for most of the problems you have living today. I am responsible for your inability to hold a job. I'm responsible for your inability to have a meaningful relationship. I'm responsible for your inability to relate to other people. I am responsible that you have these problems. She said, but on this, your first birthday in AA, please understand, you're responsible for the solutions to those problems. I can deal with that. I'm okay with that. God, that's great. Just let me know that it's not my fault I'm fucked up. I'm willing to fix it. But as long as I think I'm at fault, then I keep going through life thinking there's something wrong with me. There's nothing wrong with me. It's learned behavior. It can be undone. You know, it's like adult children of alcoholics have started, and they get there's a lot of Al-Anon flack, you know, I don't know, in different areas. There's a lot of friction between Al-Anon and ACA. There's friction between AA too, but it's worse from Al-Anon. And any Al-Anons are here, open your mind for a minute and listen to this with a grain of salt. First thing wrong with Al-Anon and ACA being together is that you have no right to tell us what to read. None. Okay? That's the same control bullshit when we were children. No, you can't read that. You can read this. Who the fuck are you to say? You know? I mean, what gave you the right? What gave you the right to dictate to me what I read? Okay? Because there's a lot of good literature out there for adult children that should be on the table at other every season. Well, why are they doing this? Al-Anons aren't bad people. It's because, in my opinion, for the first time, the behavior of the co-alcoholic is being called into the spotlight alongside the alcoholics. And it's uncomfortable for you. It's uncomfortable. Hey, for every one of us who's an adult child, we are also parents. We're also parents. It's uncomfortable for us. As I look at my parents' behavior towards me, I got to look at my behavior towards my kids. Okay? And it's no better. It's no better. It wasn't any better than they did. All right? But for the first time, somebody's saying to the co-alcoholic, why didn't you get us out? Why did you not rescue us? What was wrong with you that you had to stay in this intolerable, physically violent, unfair, insane, dysfunctional situation and not rescue your children? Okay? Remember, they're only responsible, not to blame. Okay? We work with the tools we have. That's all we can do. We work with the tools we have. Where am I today? Well, I'm 24, 23 years and 10 months, 11 months sober. I'm 50 years of age, vegetarian, I run a little bit, ride bicycles a lot. I'm probably in the top 1% in the nation from health condition for my age. I walk by a mirror nowadays occasionally, and I'll catch a glimpse of myself out of the corner of my eye, and I'll turn and smile because I like the person I see, okay?
That has not always been the case. I used to look in mirrors and hate the person that I saw. I used to go home, people at AA meeting would say, go home, look in the mirror, say, I love you. I go home, I get there in front of the mirror, you're the sickest motherfucker I ever met. And I would walk away. That was the best I could do. That's what I thought of me. Of me. Today I'm okay. I live in Southern California for 2 weeks more. I'm gone. I'm moving to Santa Fe, New Mexico. I'm going home. Never been there, but I know I'm going home. Because in the process of this therapy and all this, I've met a little child who lives inside of me. People say, oh, God, you're going to talk about the kid inside. What's the kid inside got to do with anything? It's got a lot to do with a lot of things. One of the things I've learned about the child inside is from spiritual people I have talked to, they have said, it is critical that you get in touch with this child inside because God will speak to you through that child. And I believe that. That my child, his intuition is perfect. Perfect. My intuition is perfect. It's always been perfect. Always. Everybody in this room, your intuition is perfect. You just don't listen to it. You know, I have gone to the altar to get married when my intuition would say, this is not a good idea. You know? This ain't good. You know, shut up. Everything's okay. I'm in charge here. You know? Don't bother me with that wimpy bullshit. I can handle it, you know, and away I go into the jaws of death. Yeah. Always. Always trust the intuition of children. There's some, Alice Miller has written some wonderful books about raising children. In one of her books, Drama, The Gift of Child, she says, everybody always talks about Jesus Christ. But if you want to talk about parenting, Mary and Joseph were the perfect parents because they knew they were raising the child of God. And so they chose to learn from him rather than try and make him a clone of them. In other words, he went places that they didn't understand, and he did things that they made them afraid, but they never stopped the child. They learned from the child. And think for a minute, and this is a real good one because it's happened to most people I know, at a large family gathering, you'll have little Billy. And little Billy will start to walk across the room towards Uncle Harry. Yeah, this far from Uncle Harry, he'll go. The family now goes, no, Uncle Harry, well, sweet, come on, Billy, Billy, it's okay. Billy's intuition has said, don't fuck with Uncle Harry, okay? They now pick Billy up, carry him over, and put him on Uncle Harry's knee, and he goes, nah! And they're saying, oh, no, Billy, be nice to Uncle Harry. Billy knows something nobody else in the room knows. See? And if you watch the child and learn from the child, you'll trust the child's intuition and you'll learn to trust yours. What else can I say? I'm delighted to be here to say, I know this stuff makes you uncomfortable, you know, but I'm convinced that recovery is all-consuming. It's spiritual, it's physical. I heard a Christian minister, I watch a lot of fundamentalist TV. I love it. Like I say, anxiety is my drug. No, it's and I was watching this guy the other night, about a few months ago, he's like one of the top four or five on TV, right? I mean, one of the real, really gets into it. And suddenly he says to this television congregation, he says, for those of you who are out there saying you're professing that you're Christians and that you're born again and you're overweight, it is time for you to realize you must put some consciousness into what you eat because your body is the temple of God. And if you're not taking care of the temple, you're not following the Christian... I went, I'm impressed, right? I mean, this sucker lives on checks in the mail, right? Okay? The people he's talking to are... Now, parting caution. It's a little step at a time. You do not have to walk out of this auditorium... Never drink coffee again. Throw your cigarettes in the trash can. Right? Call your parents on the phone and tell them everything you want to tell them for 164 years. Run home and leave your car here.
and eat a tree for dinner, okay? That's not required.
Just don't be afraid of your own consciousness. Don't be afraid when you start saying to you, I don't want to eat this anymore. I want to run. I want to ride a bicycle. I want to go swim in a pool. I don't want to smoke anymore. I want to be a non-smoker. It's a little piece at a time. I've been doing this stuff in the nutrition exercise and all that for about 7 years now. It's been like a 7-year process. I'm still losing a little weight at a time. And I'm delaying it, guys. I'm 50 years old. I don't want any sudden weight loss. You know what I mean? The elasticity of the skin goes out at 35, babe. You lose weight quick, you wind up standing around looking like you're standing in a sack. You know what I mean? I'm delighted it's still coming out slow. Looking good is still somewhat important, you know. I'm delighted to be asked to share your anniversary and to be part of the celebration. Man, that's my plane, goddammit. Somebody's in my plane. I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled to be part of the military. I am. I really am, man. I'm grateful to you guys who are in the military, and I'm grateful to the program that's going to keep us from winding up with a Polaris submarine loaded with heroin addicts. You know what I mean? And and be good to yourself. God bless you.
Right on, Bobby. I just wanted to announce that there will be tapes that we can...